This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution slams the colonial approach pursued by the US and its allies, saying they oppose independent democracies. The leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says Israel was behind the recent desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden. Also coming up, a new report says Israeli forces have killed 206 Palestinians since the beginning of this year, with 64 fatalities in the city of Jenin alone. Welcome. Our top story this hour: the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has criticized Western countries for their colonial pursuits. Despite claiming to be liberal democracies, Ayatollah Khamenei called those democracies a big lie. He said that Western states are opposed to freedom-seeking and any democracy which is independent of the global arrogance. He said that a clear example of such policy is Ukraine, where civilians are being killed because Western arms manufacturers seek their benefits from the continuation of the war. Elsewhere in his remarks, Iran's leader said the U.S. pursues evil acts as it confronts other nations in all fields. He said that today the West is vulnerable more than ever. Ayatollah Khamenei also noted that the steadfastness of the Iranian nation and the Islamic establishment against what he called the Western Front is in fact a cultural and global fight. Glenn Dyson, a professor of international relations at the University of Southeastern Norway, says the Western hegemony is coming to an end as the US sees its global power declining rapidly.
Well, I think that it's a reference to 500 years of hegemony coming to an end. It can be seen in many aspects. Many would put this war as a key example that after 30 years of NATO expansion, which is a way for the U.S. to project its hegemony, we see this military balancing by the Russians, which is a challenge. But it's also, and I would argue, primarily in the economic sphere, which is why the U.S. is so hostile towards China, because under Chinese leadership, most of the world outside NATO is moving to other tech centers, new industries, new transportation corridors. They're de-dollarizing using their own currency, developing their own development banks, their own payment systems. So they see a whole economic system effectively what underpins the U.S. hegemon. No dollar, there's no empire. So I think this is the weakest spot. And also this whole rules-based international order, which the U.S. has been promoting so heavily, to replace to a large extent international law, because it gives certain prerogatives to the U.S. and its allies. So, for example, it can exempt itself from international law. So it can interfere in the domestic affairs of other countries. They can topple governments. You can invade. So all of this under the guise of liberal democracy. So you see a lot of the world now rejecting all of this. So there's a huge shift. But again, it's primarily economic, and you see it expressed politically. But of course, this war should also to some extent be understood as a rejection of this effort in Europe to develop U.S. hegemony at the expense of Russian security. So there's certainly a lot of truth to this. And I think this is also why the United States is quite anxious at the moment. Its security strategy is based on not accepting the emergence of any rivals which can challenge it. And it now sees its relative power in the world declining very rapidly. So there's a lot at stake in this conflict, which is why when tensions or relations are framed in this zero-sum, winner-takes-all format, we see that countries are willing to take much greater risks. And this is exactly what we're seeing now as the world even risks a nuclear war.
President Ibrahim Raisi says expanding relations with African nations is high on the agenda of Iran's foreign policy as he's touring the continent. Raisi said Iran has developed good relations with African countries since the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He made the remarks in a meeting with his Ugandan counterpart in the capital, Kampala. The Iranian president called for boosting bilateral ties in different levels. The two sides also inked four cooperation documents. Raisi began his three-day tour by visiting Kenya. In the capital, Nairobi, Iran's president and his Kenyan counterpart highlighted the importance of boosting bilateral cooperation.
We have historic cooperation with the African continent and Kenya and believe that relations between the governments and people of Iran and Kenya can expand further. Our goal is to expand cooperation by tenfold.
I expressed our gratitude and commitment to expand and deepen these relations. President Raisi and I had the opportunity to engage views and share ideas about emerging opportunities to improve the balance of trade.
The Iranian and Kenyan presidents also signed a number of cooperation documents in various areas. Raisi also scheduled to travel to Zimbabwe on the last leg of his tour. This is the first visit to the continent by an Iranian president in over a decade. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the significance of President Raisi's tour of Africa. Here's what our guests had to say.
Joining us now for the program is Mr. Ibu Mandaza, Zimbabwean academic and author, joining us from Ngesi Omoli, chairperson of Kenya. Gentlemen, welcome to the program, to both of you. I'm going to start with Mr. Mandaza from Harare. Your initial thoughts about the Iranian president's visit to these three African countries. He has stressed before leaving the tarmac here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, that he basically finds it appalling the way the West deals with African countries as somewhat of a vassal state there to exploit and not really contribute to the righteous development of those countries, something he wants to show that Iran has a complete different perspective on, wants to be a partner both in development with respect for dignity of those countries and their right to self-determination and sovereignty. Your initial thoughts, Professor?
Well, I think it's very interesting timing of the visit to Africa in more than 10 years by an Iranian president. And I think the visit is most welcome. I noticed that he has already received a warm reception in both Uganda and Kenya. And I'm sure he'll get a similar reception in Zimbabwe, where the relations between Zimbabwe and Iran were quite intense in the early 2000s, at a time when Zimbabwe had enormous economic difficulties. And since then, I believe the relations between Zimbabwe and Iran are very, very warm. I should also add that Iran is an important factor in international affairs, in global affairs. When we were students in the 70s, Iran was, under the Shah, was one of the, what we described as the sub-imperial node of the the U.S. Gladly, this has ceased to be since 1979. Iran has become an important factor in the Middle East.
Thank you, Professor, for your initial thoughts there. I'd like to welcome Mr. Abubakar Ngisa Omole, Vice Chairperson now of the Communist Party of Kenya, joining us from Nairobi. Hello, sir. Pleasure to have you on the program here. Now, Ibrahim Raisi, the Iranian president, said that he wants to advance dialogue and contribute to the sectors of medicine, agriculture, science, and technology, and other industry. My initial question to you, sir, how can this enhancement of ties between Tehran and these three African countries enhance the situation for both sides, for Iran and for these respective countries?
Yeah, thank you very much. And first of all, I would like to say that the Kenyan people and particularly the progressive Kenyan centers have sent very warm welcome to the Iranian president visiting our country. In fact, for us, the Iranian president could not come at this most important time when our president has just, you know, pronounced, you know, the Kenyan president has just pronounced the most urgent need for an alternative, you know, the global arrangement. Remember the president Ruto was just in Paris the other day, and he talked critically about the dominance class using, you know, the global financial institution to put their hegemony on the countries of the South. So our hope is that the president of Kenya, through the friendly relationship that now Nairobi and Tehran has continued to, you know, build, will then realize the most important thing that we know Iran for, and that Iran stands as an anti-imperialist and anti-Zionist beacon in the west of Asia. And we admire the Iranian people, their resilience in terms of advancing an economy that is inward looking. Because most of the time, especially at this time that the Kenyan people are going through an economic turmoil and economic crisis, and we have had so many visitors since this regime was elected, but the most important visitor we can say that we've had this year is the president of Iran, because we have seen Iran standing tall against the arrogant, or the arrogance of the Western, you know, the dominant class in the Northern Hemisphere. And for us, we want to learn, because we have seen the role that the Iranian government and the Iranian people has played in an alternative economic arrangement. For example, every time we study about the history and the significance of the non-aligned movement, the NAM, and its challenging of the dominance arrangement in the global north, then Iran cannot be, you know, we cannot miss to mention Iran. I think even now, we hope that the raft of agreements that have been signed between Tehran and Nairobi will emulate, you know, the good examples that the Iranian people and the Iranian government have championed. For example, the most admired one and discussed here within our circles is the Iranian-Venezuela joint development, and even the Iranian, Brazil, you know, and South African agreement. So we hope that once these agreements will be published to the public, we can see their anti-imperialist character to advance an economic model that delinks the Kenyan people from the neoliberal global system that continue to affect the Kenyan people.
Gentlemen, it was a pleasure. I want to thank you both for joining us on the program. That brings us to the end of our time here on the News Review program. Professor Ibo Mandaza, they're joining us from Hurari, and Booker Ngise Omalu, they're joining us from Nairobi, Kenya. And viewers, this brings us to the conclusion of this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Moving on now, the leader of the Lebanese resistance movement, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, says Israel was behind the latest incident of the desecration of the holy Muslim book, the Quran, in Sweden. Nasrallah said the Israeli spy agency Mossad recruited a Christian Iraqi to carry out the sacrilegious act with the aim of sowing sedition between Christians and Muslims. He urged the people to be cautious about such Zionist plots. Nasrallah made the remarks during a speech on the 17th anniversary of the victory of Lebanon in a war waged by Israel. He described the victory as a significant chapter in the history of Lebanon. Nasrullah noted that the 33-day war failed to crush the resistance, adding the resistance continues to strengthen its deterrence power. He also touched on the recent Israeli large-scale attack on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin, saying the raid also failed because of the steadfastness and courage of Palestinians and resistance fighters. It has been 17 years since Israel launched a full-scale war against Lebanon. The impacts of the Israeli acts of aggression are still being discussed and analyzed. Mariam Saleh reports from Lebanon.
17 years have passed since Israel launched its biggest full-scale war against Lebanon, apart from the 1982 invasion. The Israeli Air Force bombarded the infrastructure of Lebanon, threw cluster munitions in most of southern Lebanon, and killed over 1,200 people. The town of Bint Jbeil witnessed some of the most fierce fighting during the 2006 war. This market was turned to rubble, yet that was a cost the people of Lebanon were ready to pay if it meant that Israel would be deterred from launching another act of aggression. The fighting here turned to hand-to-hand combat at times, and the Israelis were still incapable of dislodging Hezbollah while resistance rockets increased.
Here in Bint Jbeil suffered the most brutal assaults, artillery and air shelling. The Israelis used all types of weapons against us, but we were able to stay steadfast as long as our resistance was steadfast. Nothing could stop Israel except the resistance and its arms, and it's only the resistance that's protecting us, not the Security Council or human rights organizations.
When they could not crush the resistance, they began to commit massacres, trying to turn the people against the resistance. But people continued to support the resistance.
Strategy experts believe that before 2006, Hezbollah's main goal was a strategy of defense. Yet the fighting capabilities of the resistance has reached an extent where launching a preemptive war against the Israelis is plausible.
After the 2006 war, the resistance itself realized that it has capabilities beyond those of defense. They have reached the ability of initiating operations in enemy territory, as well as a necessary level of maneuver to launch an offensive. Hezbollah's Secretary General was therefore able to promise the fighters that one day they would be given a direct order to cross the border with occupied Palestine and fight on the land of the Galilee.
Israel's internal investigations into the July war proved that it was a failed mission for the regime. Yet Hezbollah's military presence remains intact and its popular support stronger than ever before. The 2006 July war gave birth to a new equilibrium in the conflict between Lebanon and Israel, and it proved that Hezbollah was not to be taken lightly. Israel's worst fear now is that any wrong move could fight Hezbollah in the Galilee region. Mariam Saleh, Marun Ras, South Lebanon.
Meanwhile, the occupying regime of Israel has killed 206 Palestinians since the beginning of this year. That's according to the Palestinian Data Center. Moti, the center said 64 Palestinians were killed in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin alone during that period, while 46 others were killed in Nablus. Israeli forces raids took their toll on other West Bank cities as well, killing a total of 29 Palestinians in Ramallah al-Khalil and occupied al-Quds. 37 Palestinian citizens were also killed by Israeli forces in the besieged Gaza Strip. The regime has escalated its violence against Palestinians under its new far-right cabinet led by Benjamin Netanyahu.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio. in the limelight.
The United Nations has steadfastly refused to retract its strong condemnation of the Israeli regime over the Israeli military's brutal aggression against the occupied West Bank city of Jenin and its refugee camp. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. The European Union's representative to the Palestinian territories, Sven Kuhn von Burgsdorf, has censured the Israeli regime over the proportionality of force it used during the two-day military onslaught on the West Bank city of Jenin and its refugee camp. Following the Zionist military's raid on Jenin, in which at least 12 Palestinians were martyred and approximately 100 others injured, he said, "We are concerned about the deployment of weaponry and weapon systems which questioned the proportionality of the military during the operation." One Israeli soldier was killed during the raid on Jenin. Israeli troops finally pulled back from Jenin on Tuesday evening, 4th of July, following a 44-hour-long incursion. The European envoy made the comments on Saturday as he led a delegation of United Nations officials and diplomats from 25 countries to the Jenin refugee camp. He said, "This cycle of violence has to end. It cannot continue. If there is no political solution to the conflict, we're going to stand here in a week's time, in a month's time, or in a year's time, with nothing changed." His remarks echoed United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres, who on Thursday, 6th of July, told reporters there was an excessive use of force by Israeli forces in its 48-hour operation, the largest that Israel has staged in the Palestinian territories since the Second Intifada of the early 2000s. Antonio Guterres also said Israeli forces had prevented the injured from receiving medical care and stopped humanitarian workers from reaching those in need. The United Nations chief, Guterres, said Israel's airstrikes and ground operations in a crowded refugee camp were the worst violence in the occupied West Bank in many years, with a significant impact on civilians. As the delegation toured the refugee camp in Jenin, residents peered out of holes left in the walls by Israeli rockets, and local authorities tested a new camp-wide alarm system to warn of future raids. The refugee camp's infrastructure was severely damaged during the Israeli onslaught. 8 kilometers of water pipes and 3 kilometers of sewage pipes were also destroyed. More than 100 houses were damaged and a number of schools were also lightly damaged, according to the United Nations. United Nations officials on Saturday, 8th of July, made a plea for funds to help rebuild the Jenin refugee camp. The Al Jazeera television network has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Zionist regime's United Nations ambassador has called on UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres to retract his condemnation of Israeli forces for using excessive force and harming civilians during their devastating raid on the refugee camp in the West Bank city of Jenin. United Nations Deputy Spokesperson Farhan Haq responded on Friday, 7th of July, saying that Antonio Guterres had conveyed his views on Israel's operation in the Jenin refugee camp, and he stands by those words. The Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, angered by Israeli air attacks on Jenin and the danger posed to the civilian population, issued a statement on Tuesday, 4th of July, in which he said the assault had left over 100 civilians injured. Uprooted thousands of residents from the Jenin refugee camp, damaged schools and hospitals, and disrupted water and electricity networks. Antonio Guterres said Israel's airstrikes and ground operations in a crowded refugee camp were the worst violence in the West Bank in many years, with a significant impact on civilians. The Secretary General of the United Nations also criticized Israel for preventing the injured from receiving medical care and humanitarian workers from reaching those in need during the military raid, which left 12 Palestinians martyred and approximately 100 others wounded. Israel's United Nations ambassador, Gilad Erdan, called the UN chief's criticism of the Israeli military assault shameful, far-fetched, and completely detached from reality. The United Nations Security Council discussed Israel's operations in Jenin behind closed doors on Friday, 7th of July, at the request of the United Arab Emirates, and received a briefing from United Nations Assistant Secretary General Khaled Khiari. Israel's United Nations Ambassador Gilad Erdan sent a letter to the 15 Council members and Antonio Guterres before the Council meeting, in which he claimed the international community and the UN Security Council must unconditionally condemn the latest Palestinian attack and hold Palestinian leadership accountable. In a statement on Wednesday, 5th of July, three independent human rights experts said the Israeli air attacks and ground actions in Jenin amounted to egregious violations of international laws and standards on the use of force and may constitute a war crime. The United Nations Security Council took no action on Friday, 7th of July. The official website of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Organization has also covered the same story and tells us more. Secretary General of the Palestinian Resistance Movement, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad al-Nakhala, says the recent battle in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin ushered in a new era in the superiority of the resistance over the Israeli military. Ziad al-Nakhala made the statement in a phone conversation on Sunday, 9th of July, with the families of a number of martyrs from the deadly Israeli assault on Jenin and its refugee camp in recent days. Nakhala hailed as a great triumph for the resistance groups the Israeli regime's defeat in its recent aggression on Jenin, and stressed that the movement takes pride in every drop of blood in the latest battle. Underlining the solid will of the Palestinian people in confronting the Israeli regime, Ziad Nakhala said the victory was an extension of all the heroic battles led by the Al-Quds Brigades, the military wing of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, and other Palestinian resistance groups. He said, "What happened in the Jenin refugee camp is a great triumph in the face of Zionist aggression, led by the Jenin Battalion in the Al-Quds Brigades and all the resistance forces." Ziad Nakhala added, "What happened establishes a new era that the upper hand is for our people and their solid resistance." Nakhala also expressed gratitude to the residents of Jenin and the residents of the Jenin refugee camp in particular, for their support for the resistance fighters and their combat against Israel. The English website of the Islamic Republic of Iran news agency IRNA has also covered the same story and tells us more. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has hailed the steely resistance of Palestinians in the face of Israeli military's two-day onslaught on the Jenin refugee camp, saying the occupying regime suffered a humiliating defeat in the battle for Jenin. In a tweet on Sunday, 9th of July, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani wrote that the trail of destruction left behind in the Jenin refugee camp marks a shameful moral failure for the supporters of the Israeli regime. Kanani said the war machine of the criminal Israeli regime suffered a new historic defeat in the recent brutal onslaught in Jenin. Nonetheless, he said, a much bigger defeat awaits the supporters of the Israeli regime. Nasser Kanani further underlined that the scale of destruction in the Jenin camp marks a flagrant violation of international law and constitutes a war crime. He also called on Palestinians to expose such levels of aggression to the world so that the so-called advocates of human rights would become more disgraced. Thousands of Jordanians have staged a massive rally to express their unwavering support for the Palestinian people and their resistance in the face of Israel's two-day military onslaught on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. The Jordanian demonstrators, which came from across the political spectrum, participated in the rally organized following Friday prayers in the Jordanian capital Amman to mark the victory of the Palestinians and resistance fighters in the Jenin refugee camp.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
She in the dark found light brighter than many ever see. She within herself found loveliness through the soul's own mastery. And now the world receives from her dower the message of strength and of inner power. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, dear listeners of IRB English Radio, you are listening to Muslim Lady. Yes, that was a poem about all of you, all the ladies from all around the world. I hope you're doing well and you're enjoying every second of your precious life. I am Asma at your service as the host. And today with us, we have Sister Zainab to brighten our world more and more.
Assalamu alaikum and thank you for having me.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be here with you. And just like always, we're talking about women. This is Strong Creatures. And, recently we've been talking about different aspects of ladies' lives. And right now, I guess, it's good to have a hint on the time. Well, we don't get old. This is a fact for every single woman in this world. Well, age is just something that has been written somewhere. It's the creation of human beings and we do not care for it. But in case we just get old and we are called aged women, we have some expectations and life changes in our eyes.
Right.
The perspective we have toward other people and toward life is going to change.
Right. Yes, expectations basically vary based on the personal experiences mm-hmm. and the cultural backgrounds. Some research suggests that, expectations grow with age.
Yeah.
Because people who grow older have more experience and knowledge about what is possible and what is desirable. Like, there's a child, for example, as a child is young, he only knows toys and he only wants toys.
Mm-hmm.
But when his world of knowledge increases, he yeah. gets exposed to the world and he sees other things. Now he sees the parks, now he goes for the trips, and then he wants all of them. Now his expectations
exactly.
increase. So expectations yeah. do increase with age. There's no doubt about it.
Because your world is going to get bigger and bigger, and that's why you have more of expectations.
Exactly. And now, since in this world where the women have been exposed to a more, I would say to many worlds mm-hmm. where she was not exposed to before, like in the ancient times, women was not exposed much. She did not have enough exposure, so she had least expectations. But now the woman has been exposed to, well, no, you are an extraordinary creature and you have
You mean all this fancy world around us that tells us, okay, you're a model, you are a doll, you're something beautiful.
I would say unrealistic world that has been exposed, that has been introduced to a woman, has increased basically her expectations.
Yeah.
So all that comes with the, you know, increase of the information, the more you get exposed to something, and also the different societies, different backgrounds. And there are also some researchers, though, who suggest that expectations shrink with age because they become more realistic and content, you know. Definitely, you get exposed to a world, but your knowledge also increases.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're more realistic. Yeah. Now you're more content.
So you don't expect much.
Yeah.
So there are two perspectives.
Exactly. So there's no definitive answer, basically, to this question that as different people may have different expectations for themselves and others at different stages of life. Because, as we said, based on the cultural backgrounds and the knowledge they have and the experiences.
And by the way, it depends on the background you're coming from, the family you had, the context you're living in. Maybe you have been growing as a pampered child. So just add to that being a woman, a girl, then just what kind of a misery is going to happen.
Exactly. But there are some research as well which suggests that, like we could say, most of the times it's that with age expectations grow, and there are reasons, like based on the life stage and developmental goals, elderly people have different expectations.
Yeah.
Especially when it comes to social relationships.
Exactly.
You know, for example, when a woman grows old, she expects more availability, more care, support, understanding.
This understanding is very important.
Exactly. Because as they grow old, they want you to understand them as they understood you.
Yeah.
In your times.
I guess.
Like when I as a teen was very rebellious.
Yeah.
It was my mom or my grandmom who understood me. When I have grown to that stage, it's a vice versa kind of process.
Exactly.
It's a two-way.
Yeah, yeah.
So you also have, and we have a lot of religious teachings, what they say about the behavior that should be going on. But what are they trying to say? They kind of are loudly saying something. Mm-hmm. They're saying there's a need for security. There's a need of belongingness. They need self-esteem and they need self-actualization.
Yeah, that's very true. So just to add it in here, I have to say that expectations are just not for women. All the human beings, I guess, as they grow older, they have some expectations, and it's pretty much natural. And it's, I guess, their right to have some expectations, of course, realistically. But since women are so delicate and they're just like these flowers that are so precious to everyone, and at the same time, they're so breakable. So that's why we're talking about it. And we said that it's most probably because of the fact that they want to be understood by others and they want to be taken care of.
That support and...
Yeah, and they long for support.
Yeah.
That's the fact. So let's keep it in here. Go for a short break, and then we'll be back. Dear ladies, the diamonds of our lives, welcome back to today's episode. Well, you're listening to Muslim Lady. We're talking about you and what is your concern. So today we're talking about the expectations that we get as we grow older. And it is not just for women, but since this program is devoted to all the dear women, so we talk about them.
Yeah, so we were saying that as you know, women grow old, or they have this more concern of someone being available to them for care, for their support, they need generativity, they need respect, and they need value from all their social contacts that they have. It's not just from the, you know, I would say sons or daughters. they expect from the social contacts they have. And these expectations, as we said, they reflect something that's the need of security and the self-esteem, self-actualization, and their belongingness and all. There was an article published in the Journal of Perspectives on Psychological Science titled Understanding and Addressing Older Adults' Loneliness, The Social Relationship Expectations Framework. It was by Akhtar Khan and others. So what they say in this that these expectations are influenced by universal human needs and age-specific developmental tasks.
Yeah, so it's pretty natural.
Yeah. So such expectations are basically shaped by various contextual factors that we have been talking about, like such as culture, functional limitations, social network changes even, and the personal experiences, obviously. So therefore, as we grow old, the social relationship expectations are not fixed or homogeneous. They get, you know, broader, they get diverse, they are more dynamic. So there's also some research that suggests that expectations may indeed increase for women as they grow older.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like,
because they are more into details.
Yeah. And there was one study conducted by the researchers at the University of Michigan in 2014 by Twenge and others who found that women's aspirations and expectations tend to increase as early as they are peaking around the age of 30. So now there was a research done which showed, yes, as they grow 30, now the expectations tend to increase comparatively to those who are younger women.
That's nice.
Yeah. And there are also other studies who have highlighted that social and cultural factors shape women's expectations over time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, research has shown that women often subject to gendered expectations around family and caregiving, which can create conflicting demands and pressures as they basically navigate through different stages of life.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So apart from all this, like what we said so far, there is this societal message about beauty and aging that contributes to the unrealistic expectations of women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just see the bombardment of advertisements or the propaganda on the social media about beauty, about aging. This really grows unrealistic expectations in women, and which only would lead them into hurt and nothing else. Because expectations could be sometimes realistic, which could be met, which even Islam guides us how to meet those, how to understand those. But sometimes there are some unrealistic expectations which the world today has created.
Yeah, and overrated ones that you do not have to care for.
Which you really, which there's no way out to it.
Yeah.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
So, sister, if I want to ask you a question as a lady yourself, imagine 10 years later, the thing that will make you get into more of expectations from the people around you is?
My family. Mostly the people who are very close to me. My first circle. Like as per psychology.
And the thing that makes you feel like you have some special expectations from them is what? What makes you have more expectations from them?
The attachment I have or the belongingness I have to my family. And that would be definitely the support I would be needing. I would be in need of when I would grow like older. Definitely, you don't have that physical ability, then you don't have that courage then.
So that's the reason why when we get older, we want people to care for us. Because we think that, okay, now I'm a useless creature and I cannot be as productive as I was once or in my 30s, in my 20s. So I feel like maybe people around me would no longer care for me. And I would love them to have more support and love towards me. So I guess it's a sort of a shout out for love.
Right.
Of course, a single document is not going to show my worth, but after a certain age, I start to compare myself to other women, and then if I did not have as tangible achievements as they have, I might go through some hallucinations that, okay, I am useless perhaps, and I haven't done much in my life, and since I'm a woman, and society is going to look at me as a creature that no longer has this validity to work with other numbers of the society. So this was all the time that we had for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Well, it was all about you, all about women, and as they get older, well, I would like to call it aged women, not right. old, because we don't get old, and because age is something that remains in your heart. You can be a 70-year-old woman and at the same time feel as a 7-year-old girl in your heart.
Right.
So, yeah, keep yourself young and love yourself and try to have some realistic expectations in case you have expectations in your life, because expectations would lead nowhere except the ruin of you. And thank you for being with us. Thank you, sister. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
The results of the latest studies carried out in Britain show that half of the British people are worried about the sudden increase in the cost of living on a daily basis and cannot afford their living expenses. According to the findings, more than half of the British people use less fuel, such as gas and electricity, at home, and almost half of them have cut down on food and non-essential travel. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Sky News has covered this story and tells us more. Some UK military personnel and their families have been forced to use food banks as high inflation and rising costs tip members of the armed forces into crisis. A Defence Ministry source said an unofficial food bank even exists at a large Royal Air Force base in Lincolnshire. The voluntary facility at RAF Coningsby, home to Typhoon fast jet squadrons, was set up by an aviator to collect food donations from servicemen and women to support civilians in their local community. But the source said it is now being used by RAF personnel too. Internal RAF documents seen by Sky News, as well as interviews with military sources and charities, offer a sense of the wider impact of the cost of living crisis on defence, including the need for a number of service personnel to choose between food or fuel, with some unable to afford to drive home from their base to see their family. One aviator, a single mother, was forced to go without a hot meal for 4 days because she had spent her last money on baby milk formula. The volume of inquiries to a key charity from or on behalf of military personnel seeking financial support has more than doubled. There are individuals who can no longer even afford the price of the subsidized meals at their mess, and a sense of discontent at covering for striking public sector workers on better pay deals when the armed forces are not permitted to take industrial action themselves. While the document referred to the situation inside the RAF base at Coningsby, a Royal Navy source and an Army source said personnel in their respective services were also experiencing hardship. The Royal Navy source said the UK's Ministry of Defence was trying to do more to help, such as support with childcare costs. The source said, "But I suspect more needs to be done." The source added, "I'm hearing stories of sailors unable to head home at weekends or over leave periods due to travel costs. Also, service personnel using food banks or contacting service charities for assistance with debt management." The United Kingdom provides its armed forces with some benefits, such as access to state-subsidized housing and subsidized meals, as well as fuel grants in a bid to keep the offer to join the Army, Navy and RAF attractive and to retain talent. The support is also in recognition of the particular hardships and inconveniences of military life and the fact that anyone who serves has to be prepared to make the ultimate sacrifice. An anonymous quote in a report read, "The food bank is popular," according to the footnote in the report, which was entitled "Chaplaincy Analysis of Whole Force Morale 2022 and dated 12th of January 2023, the air bases RAF Benson in South Oxfordshire and RAF Bryce Norton in Oxfordshire are reporting the highest use of food banks. Overall, the report found that cost of living pressures as well as failings with military accommodation such as faulty heating and vermin were the biggest factors adversely impacting morale. The Daily Express has also covered the same story and tells us more. A UK defence source with knowledge of the food bank at Royal Air Force Coningsby Base, home to Typhoon fastjet squadrons, said that service personnel had been using the facility extensively. Asked how they felt about this, the source said, "Incredibly angry and frustrated that we had to go to the point where the service personnel had to rely on charitable agencies just to exist." A junior non-commissioned officer established a food bank at RAF Coningsby, which has its own Facebook page, a couple of years ago to support the local civilian community, having been involved with this kind of charitable activity whilst posted overseas in the United States. According to the Facebook page, the food bank is run by a Christian group called Destiny Outreach Coningsby. It says it offers support to people living in the town of Coningsby and the surrounding villages. A RAF spokesperson made clear that the food bank was not set up by the RAF for its personnel. However, the spokesperson did not offer a comment on the record about the claim that serving aviators were using the facility. The Ministry of Defence, the MOD, is understood to regard any use of food banks by military personnel as a private life matter and does not have any data to support claims of their alleged use. However, officials at RAF Coningsby raised concern with Air Command last July about a worrying increase in personnel seeking assistance and support across all welfare pillars as a direct result of the cost of living crisis. The warning was contained in a report dated 22nd of July 2022, which was entitled Cost of Living Crisis, RAF Coningsby. It mentioned the establishment of the food bank. The report drew on information gathered from the experiences of four focus groups of about 150 personnel and families over a one-week period. It listed several trends, including personnel struggling to afford fuel to drive to work, personnel unable to travel home each week and having to stay on unit, reducing morale and well-being, real concern for the winter months where electricity and gas costs will further exacerbate the current situation. The documents and defence sources said pay is another factor creating pressure for Britain's military, especially given soaring inflation. The chaplaincy analysis talked about a sense of looming discontent as service personnel may be called upon to fill in for public sector workers who are striking for better wages. The Armed Forces Pay Review Body, an independent entity, makes a recommendation each year to the government on any pay increases for the military, which the Ministry of Defence, the MOD, draws upon before making its announcement on what the amount will be. This should happen before the start of each financial year, but is often delayed and any increase in salary is backdated to the beginning of April. The Ministry of Defence has yet to announce this year's settlement, though the pay review body has submitted its recommendations and an announcement is expected soon. One RAF aviator described the process as an annual gamble on what we may or may not receive. Asked what message they had for the government, the aviator said, "Understand that your military deserves to be fairly compensated for the role that they play in support of the United Kingdom on all fronts. We see through the words and false promises and expect to be treated fairly in return for our commitment to our country." Sarah Atherton, MP, an Army veteran and member of the House of Commons Defence Select Committee, said the government should give the military a 10% pay rise in line with inflation.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.